You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligence Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates, and events for over two decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity, and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? To find out what we can do for your organization, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligencesquared.com/partnerships.
Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome to this week's episode of the Sunday Debate. Today, we're going all the way back to 2011. When we staged the motion, the war on terror was the right response to 9/11. Now, it's particularly interesting to look back on what opinion was a decade ago in light of recent events in Afghanistan and beyond. And this debate is packed with well-known political figures, from former President of Pakistan, Pervez Musharraf, and former UK Permanent Representative at the United Nations, Sir Jeremy Greenstock. We hope you enjoyed, and now let's go to the chair, the BBC's Zainab Badawi.
Hello, I'm Zainab Badawi. Welcome to this Intelligence Squared debate coming to you from Cadogan Hall in central London. It's exactly 10 years ago that 9/11 happened. Nearly 3,000 people were killed in those attacks in America, and they changed the course of world history forever. The motion in our debate, a decade on, was the war on terror the right response to 9/11? And in our panel, we have some of the key figures from that time. Pervez Musharraf was president of Pakistan. He is arguing for the motion, along with Colleen Graffy, who served in the Bush administration. Arguing against the motion, Sir Jeremy Greenstock, who was the senior British diplomat at the time, and the influential French politician, Dr. Bernard Kouchner. That's our panel. Welcome to you all. As you, our audience, were coming in, you were asked to vote to see where you stand on the motion right now. Then each of our panel members will make their opening statements to you. Then you will have a chance to put questions or even make comments, indeed, to our panel members. And we will ask you to vote again to see if you've perhaps changed your mind and where the vote there stands. So I hope that's all clear. We can start our debate arguing for the motion, the war on terror was the right response to 9/11. Pervez Musharraf, who was president of Pakistan from 1999 until 2008, and of course he was a crucial figure in the war on terror, particularly when it came to the invasion of neighboring Afghanistan. General Musharraf.
In September 2001, ladies and gentlemen, the world leaders, and I happen to be one of them, had to decide whether fighting the war on terror would make the world a safer place to live in. I then believed, and still do believe, that we had, and continue to have even now, a responsibility to act decisively to root out terrorism. We need to be clear that the call for action was certainly not based on the single incident of 9/11. 9/11, in fact, was the catalyst, the culmination of a series of increasingly bloody terrorist outrages, which finally tipped the scales against the prevalent law enforcement approach. It roused universal condemnation and forced the strong action against terror. Ladies and gentlemen, terror has to be defeated. There is no running away from it. The destructive power of the explosive and the viciousness of the suicide bombers who bring misery to people at large, to innocent people at large, has to be combated. Holistically, the war on terror has three fronts: the military, the political, and the socio-economic. We have a tendency to overuse the military instrument, to pay lip service to the socio-economic, and almost ignore the political element. It is this short-sightedness of the past that perhaps saved Al-Qaeda from defeat. I have two arguments to justify this statement that I've just made. Firstly, had the world recognized the Taliban after 1996, when they controlled more than 90% of Afghanistan, maybe we could have moderated them from within. Now, coming to the second missed political opportunity. The aftermath of the military success of the 9/11 response had to be capitalized with the shift and the application of the political instrument. Al-Qaeda and their abettors, the Taliban, were defeated, were militarily defeated, and they were in total disarray. Their organizational and command structure was dismantled in Afghanistan, and they ran helter-skelter into the mountains and cities of Pakistan. A truly representative national government, which gave proportional representation to all the ethnic groups, could have brought peace into Afghanistan and maybe also ousted Al-Qaeda. Ladies and gentlemen, the complexity of terrorism has increased now. Their center of gravity lies in Afghanistan and the tribal agencies of Pakistan. We have to defeat them at the center of gravity. Losing here means defeat elsewhere and everywhere. In conclusion, ladies and gentlemen, may I say that we can criticize, we can disagree with the conduct, with the execution, with the handling of the war on terror. But the world cannot absolve itself from its collective responsibility of fighting and defeating the war and defeating terrorism in the world. Thank you very much.
Arguing against the motion, our next speaker, Sir Jeremy Greenstock. He was the UK's representative at the United Nations for 5 years, including during 2001, and then in 2003 he became the UK special representative in Iraq after the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, and he continues to influence thinking on foreign policy still through his writings and his work. Sir Jeremy Greenstock, your time starts when you get to the lectern.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have just heard a supreme military leader defending the use of military means to overcome a threat that, for all its use of violence, was not military. Indeed, the threat is all the more powerful because it comes from methods of attack that aim to neutralize to the greatest extent possible the vast military superiority of the target. To fine-tune the response to an attack, you have to understand what the attack was all about and who was behind it. Al-Qaeda's fundamental purpose in planning 9/11 and other attacks on American and Western interests was to create a situation in the Islamic world in which a particular, many would say a bizarre, interpretation of Islam could thrive politically and religiously. enticing the world's only superpower into a war or a series of wars in the Middle East was seen as the route to social and political chaos there, out of which something new could emerge with enough popular support to be sustainable. Making the United States so angry as to be prone to misjudgments, such as the doctrine of preventive war, was an essential step in this design. In the global picture, this was about more than terrorism. Washington, on a war footing, then made a mistake which played into al-Qaeda's hands. Al-Qaeda's recognition that the US might be goaded into becoming a hammer looking for a nail was proved accurate in the US decision to invade and occupy Iraq in 2003, when Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. Now is not the time for a detailed analysis of the effects of the Iraq decision, but it's my belief that the war in Iraq has complicated our capacity to deal with terrorism internationally and expanded the range of pretexts for terrorists to use violence both against the West and against fellow Muslims. In short, if the war on terror was the right response, then terrorism, after trillions of dollars of expenditure on military operations and hundreds of thousands of deaths, should be on its last legs. Too many people saw the US as taking forward a war of its own conception and in its own national interests, without addressing the concerns of others. The opportunity for the Americans to lead a global, collective approach to security issues was lost. The new counterterrorism of the Obama administration, it's interesting to observe, largely recognizes and seeks to correct that original misconception of what counterterrorism should be all about. Strong, precise action to deal with criminal groups has to be combined with diplomacy and partnership, is what that new strategy says. And that's quite a different approach from a war on terror. It's hard to avoid the conclusion that the United States made this change much too late. Let's show in your vote tonight that we have at least learnt that lesson. Thank you very much.
Sir Jeremy Greenstock, thank you very much indeed. Arguing for the motion, we now have Colleen Graffy, who was an Assistant Secretary of State in the US State Department in George W. Bush's second term. Colleen Graffy, your time starts when you get to the podium.
The war on terror was the right response to 9/11. The fact is, the military approach has worked. In the decades since 9/11, al-Qaeda's actions have not kept pace with their aspirations. Coordinated attacks of a global reach have fallen, and we are working so that it remains so. We learned from recently recovered documents that Osama bin Laden was lamenting from his bunker that the drone strikes were preventing training and reducing capable leadership. The fact that war was the right response to 9/11 is reinforced by the fact that the Obama administration, after great scrutiny and great deliberation, has actually continued on the same course. In fact, he's increased drone strikes. Nothing short of war was needed to get at the root causes of terrorism. And the root causes of terrorism are the Middle East dictators and tyrants who suck the air out of public discourse and prevent the development of civil society. This leaves only mosques as the place for people to vent. Unfortunately, it is also the place where people are radicalized into a perverted version of Islam which hopes to replace one tyranny with another, their own. For 60 years, the United States' desire for stability was more important than pushing for democratic reforms in the Middle East. The war on terror led to a significant and strategic change in the U.S. foreign policy, one that allowed for America's vital interests and deepest beliefs to become one. It led to the freedom agenda, which was committed to supporting the democratic aspirations of all people. Nothing short of war would have changed the power structures in Afghanistan and Iraq. And make no mistake, the change was a catalyst for what we see today, the Arab Spring and the crumbling of tyrants from Tunisia to Egypt, Libya, and hopefully more to come. Don't take it from me. Listen to a voice from the region. Lebanese political leader Walid Shamblat, during Lebanon's 2005 Cedar Revolution, said, "It's strange for me to say it, but this progress of change has started because of the American invasion of Iraq. I was cynical about Iraq, but when I saw the Iraqi people voting 3 weeks ago, 8 million of them, it was the start of a new Arab world. The Syrian people, the Egyptian people, all say that something is changing. The Berlin Wall has fallen. We can see it." To our Western eyes, Afghanistan and Iraq alternate between depressing and discouraging, with glimmers of hope in between. But to those in the Middle East who have only lived under tyrants and thought that this was the way it was and always would be, seeing the end of Saddam Hussein was the first crack in the edifice. With the end of his regime, a man who represented the ultimate symbol of despotic rule in the region, came the prospect that other regimes, other Saddams, may also fall. The Cold War, the War on Terror, the Overseas Contingency Operation, the name is secondary to the nature of what each represents, a commitment to overturning tyranny and the freeing of the human spirit. The War on Terror was the right response to 9/11.
Thank you very much indeed, Colleen Graffy.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed, so you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
And our final speaker in these opening statements is Dr. Bernard Kouchner, the French socialist politician. Until the end of last year, he was France's foreign minister in the government of the centre-right President Nicolas Sarkozy. During 9/11, he was serving in the French cabinet as health minister. Dr. Kouchner, please return.
So, the war on terror, was it the right answer to 9/11? Honestly, this is difficult to say yes or no, completely separate. Yes, it was imperative to react to 9/11 by war. Are you asking for an ethical, a military, or a political judgment? Let me be blunt. Ethically, it was imperative for the US to react. Politically, the way the Bush administration did has not been a complete success. 10 years after, what was the real goals? To defeat bin Laden and Al-Qaeda? Now he's dead. His organization may be weakened, but it survived and, some say, proliferates in Africa. I remember the horrified moment of 9/11. We, our American friends and their allies, we had to respond and to fight back, but not only by force. And I'm not so far, President Musharraf said. It should have been also a war against poverty. Poverty is the main word in Afghanistan and also in Pakistan. In chasing bin Laden, Western leaders discovered a reality that only those remembering the Soviet war knew. Afghanistan is a patchwork of tribes, starting with the Pashtun, more or less close to the Taliban and more or less linked to bin Laden. The Pashtun lives on both sides of two countries. There are no borders between Afghanistan and Pakistan. The Pashtun move freely. So should we have to make war on Pakistan? Impossible. Two good reasons. The Pakistanis are supposed to be our allies, and they have atomic weapons. There is only one certainty. The U.S. and its allies cannot win this war militarily. Our public opinion will not tolerate for long to see coffins coming back home for no clear purpose. And there is also one fact. Bin Laden is dead, and he was killed in Pakistan. We must absolutely, and Jeremy was very good on that, make the distinction in between the so-called war on terror and the war in Iraq. Was Saddam a respectable leader? Certainly not. He was a dictator and the butcher of his own people. In February 2003, I wrote an article in Le Monde. It was a big noise in France. No to Saddam, no to the war. So the real issues, in conclusion, today, 10 years after 9/11, are the people of Afghanistan and the people of Iraq any better off? Yes, in a way. Schools, education, hospital, roads, etc. We looked at the wrong generation. I believe, and this is part of the answer, resides in the hopes of the Arab Spring and the young Arab leaders. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So, you've heard from our speakers. It's now the turn of the audience. But before we take questions and comments from you, let me just tell you how you all voted as you were coming into the to Cadogan Hall today. So, our motion, the war on terror, was the right response to 9/11. This is how you voted. For the motion, 179. Against the motion, that's your side, 323. Don't be too quick, because the don't knows are 200. So, panel, there's a great deal you can do. Your side, you can try your best. You can try your best to win over those 200s who don't know. So let's go there. Yep.
after 9/11, there was an outpouring of goodwill towards the United States. I want to suggest to you that that outpouring of sympathy was wasted. But what would have been much better, in order to get so many of the Arab countries on side for any kind of war on terror, was a resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Without that, no Arab country could possibly have joined in a war on terror because of the bitterness and resentment caused by the plight of the Palestinians.
Thank you. We'll come to it in a moment. One more and then...
I was wondering, particularly to Mr. Musharraf, but to all the panellists, what your opinion was on the Obama administration's drone attacks in Pakistan, which have increased quite a lot recently, and whether you condone them.
OK, one more.
My question to Dr. Byrne. Your government banned a burqa in French, yeah?
Yeah.
That act supporting a terrorism, 100%, yeah? While you intervene in the personal behavior of Muslims. So what you think, is Western not supporting a terrorism by putting that kind of sanctions?
So your question is, the French have banned the wearing of the veil.
The hijab.
Yeah.
So by doing these kind of things, is not that kind of act promoting a terrorism in the East?
Right. Okay, well, Dr. Kushner, you can make that connection.
Extremism must be defeated. To compare extremism in the Middle East, in between Palestinian and Israelis and in the Middle East, generally speaking, was not right. And at the beginning of Bin Laden terrorism, it was not a question of that. But if you want me to say, and we will be all in agreement, that we must set up a real peace, that is to say, to recognize a Palestinian state, etc., yes, we have to, and we try. But honestly, it's very far from the reality of Pakistan, Afghanistan, and the rest.
Okay.
That is not to say that if we can, please...
Just to finish on the Palestinian issue, because I'd like to go...
This is an emergency, but it's an emergency since years and years. And we all try to do so and will succeed.
Okay.
But, well, it was not the reason, and it's not an explanation.
All right, but Colleen Graffy, this was a point that was raised a great deal, and the terrorists in their messages and so on bring up this issue of the Palestinian question. Bush administration... didn't really address that properly.
The problem with that argument is that if that were really the case, why didn't Osama bin Laden pause all of the planning for 9/11 when Clinton was on the brink of trying to make a breakthrough with Arafat? That wasn't the point of 9/11. That wasn't what they were gearing through. The whole Middle East crisis is a red herring to drive attention away from the dictators and tyrants across the Middle East.
So, Jeremy, do you agree with that?
There's no doubt that the United States lost an opportunity to get global sympathy. There's no doubt that Al-Qaeda had very little to do with the Palestinian issue. But that misses the point that the general support out there for doing things that are violent against the West is fed by the stagnation of the Palestinian issue, even if Al-Qaeda did not rely on that for its own influence. The fact that it's still out there, getting worse, does nothing for our counterterrorism campaign.
One thing that was mentioned by both of the opposition, and that was this connection between 9/11 and Iraq. There was no connection between 9/11 and Iraq, and the Bush administration never made that case. They said Okay, read, ladies and gentlemen, read anything on what the Bush administration has written, anything, and you will see that they said, what is the connection after 9/11? It's Al-Qaeda and it's Afghanistan. Does it have any connection in Iraq? No, it doesn't. So therefore, do we do both together? No, because it's only about Al-Qaeda and Afghanistan. After that happened, that's when Bush looked around and said, all right, we have a rogue country, as Jeremy Greenstock has said, that has been in violation of 16 UN resolutions under Chapter 7, which means use force if necessary.
Right.
And the conclusion was, do you let someone who we know has been a threat, not to the America, but to the world, do you let that stand after 9/11? So The administration never made the connection that it was that. It was a separate threat.
Since you've brought that up, let's just go to the audience on that specific question of September the 11th and no connection between those attacks and Iraq. Who wants to address that point specifically that Colin Graffy has just raised? There.
Professor Graffy is simply right. There was no connection between the terrorists of 9/11 and Iraq, but there was a connection between the issue of terrorism and Iraq in this sense. Dr. Kushner, of whom I'm a great admirer, is mistaken in counterposing the war on terror to a war on poverty and illiteracy, because the terrorists of 9/11 were not poor, and they were not from a poor region. The variable most closely connected with terrorism is a lack of political openness, whereby dissent migrates to the mosque and radicalism is incubated.
Right.
That was the connection between Iraq and 9/11.
So there was a terror threat from Iraq, but not linked to 9/11. Does somebody else want to? Yep.
My question is for Professor Graffy. You mentioned the drone attacks were successful in stopping training camps, but you failed to mention how many civilian lives have been lost as a result of those drone attacks. Are we meant to just look the other way and pretend like Pakistani lives aren't valuable?
Okay, well, we'll link that question to the other one earlier on about the... Why don't we ask you, the drone attacks on Pakistan and your view on that, General Musharraf and then Colin Graffy?
Certainly it is not in Pakistan's interest. And drone attacks are, as this young lady has said, they are causing collateral damage. Therefore, there is a great public outcry against the drone attacks. And also, may I say, there is a public outcry because it violates the sovereignty of Pakistan. However, I do not say that we should not attack the terrorists. Whenever a target is identified, we need to adopt measures to attack that target, those militants, through means which will avoid collateral damage and ensure the sovereignty of Pakistan.
The fact is that any loss of life is, of course, horrible. But the drone attacks are a technology that allows the most exact and precise targeting that we've ever known in history. And so if you're looking at the various means of military use, the drones are going to have the least effect on the civilian population of anything else.
Okay, let's take some more questions. Remember what the motion is up there.
To Mr. Greenstock, Mr. Kushner, Bernard. Policing was the policy of most Western governments up to 9/11. It failed miserably. I'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
Okay. Oh, well, yeah.
We haven't discussed the actual reason that Al-Qaeda gave for attacking, which was the presence of U.S. troops in the Holy Land in Saudi Arabia. And in order to respond to being attacked by that, they could either have left, as they did from Lebanon in 1986, fearing more terror, or they could have stayed, and I think it's fairly clear that the Saudi kingdom would have been greatly endangered, or they could leave in victory and not have to protect Saudi from Saddam anymore. I'm curious what the advocates of law enforcement would claim was the non-violent way of making the troops in Saudi redundant.
Well, the Americans did withdraw their base from Saudi Arabia, didn't they?
Yeah,
they announced,
because they invaded Iraq.
Yeah, okay, we'll put that question to the panel. Let's take some. Go ahead.
I wish to ask Pervez Musharraf, do you think Osama bin Laden came back to Pakistan after you were removed, deposed? And prior to when you were still in government in Pakistan, do you think Osama bin Laden was in Yemen, where there is his family come from and there's a very strong Islamic following?
Okay, one there, and then we'll go to the panel.
My question actually is to Professor Graffy. You said that military dictators were one of the sort of root causes of terrorism, that they sucked the air out of the democratic process, and that in many ways to depose them you needed direct Western intervention and kind of boots on the ground. I wonder, would you reconsider that statement following the aftermath of the events in Libya, where despite, you know, NATO air cover, the fight has mainly been waged by the Libyan people. There have been no direct Western intervention in terms of troops, and a dictator has been successfully overthrown with a period of relative order, unlike in Iraq, where there were hundreds of thousands of troops, and there seemed to be eternal chaos after it, or at least in the first several years.
Okay, very briefly then, first of all, Colleen Graffy. I mean, just would Saddam Hussein have gone in the Arab Spring, do you think, with all the others?
I just want to say thank you very much for that question. I think you misunderstood what I said. My point was that Iraq and Afghanistan were the catalyst for these other countries, that with the fall of Saddam Hussein, it allowed these other countries to see a different vision of what the Middle East could be like. And so, therefore, I entirely agree with you. All of these things should be homegrown, and we need to work so hard now on developing civil society, rule of law, and good governance.
Are you saying the Arab Spring would not have happened unless Iraq and Afghanistan were invaded?
I'm saying that Iraq was the catalyst, as I read from Walid Jumblood. This was something that had never seen before.
But you're extrapolating from what Walid Jumblatt said.
You know where is Walid Jumblatt now? Yes. He's close to Saddam. He's close to Bashar al-Assad.
We should just say who Walid Jumblatt is, of course. He's the veteran Druze leader in Lebanon, been there for a long time.
He changed several times camps, and now he's Syria.
So the answer is no.
But are you saying, and it's interesting to hear what the panel said, are you saying then quite clearly that without Iraq and Afghanistan being invaded and Saddam Hussein and the Taliban going, that we would not have seen the Arab Spring and Bin Ali leaving?
I said quite clearly that Iraq and Afghanistan were the catalyst for what we're seeing today.
The catalyst.
Yes.
Do you agree with that? President Musharraf, they were the catalyst, Iraq and Afghanistan, for the Arab Spring.
I am the partner to Colleen, so I would not like to disagree.
I believe that's a yes.
What about you, gentlemen?
You are putting me in a very difficult situation, must say.
Well, we can work out what your answer is on that then. Sir Jeremy.
One sentence on the Arab Spring. The Arab Spring was a spontaneous reaction by people empowered by the availability of information, knowing what was going on in the rest of the world, against their government stealing freedom and national wealth from them. It is all about that.
It was, pushing on this particular point, the catalyst, which took 8 years, though, didn't it, from 2003 to... But anyway, yes.
And that's the
catalyst of Iraq and Afghanistan.
Cedar Revolution was 2005. Palestinian was before that. I mean, it's in steps in progress. It doesn't happen overnight. Look at the Berlin Wall.
Bernard Kouchner, on this point about Afghanistan, the war on terror and the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan was the catalyst for seeing the Arab Spring and these dictators falling.
No, but I completely agree with what Jeremy said. This is a fantastic movement, Arab Spring. Spontaneous in a way that we were waiting for Muslim Brothers or extremists, etc. And the people, all the people, what we call the civil society, rejected their dictator. And don't, let's say, mix all the countries. Tunisia was not Egypt, was not Libya, etc. And we don't have
But the specific point is, people said Saddam Hussein has gone from power, and that in a way encourages us to also seek democracy.
I don't think so.
You don't
look
think
at what's happening now in Iraq. Okay. Look, this is not a miracle.
Oh, you've decided.
But what? Saddam Hussein was a dictator. He was a killer. And now there is a president of Iraq with a Kurd. This is a good success. The Shiite, the majority of the people, are in power against the minority, the Sunnis. This is another success. But it will take time. And for the time being, democracy, a sort of democracy, not the British or the Swedish or the French democracy, step by step, it will be done. Yeah. But it has not started anything. Don't remember
you
that.
You made that point. Pervez Musharraf.
We are talking about Iran.
General Musharraf has decided. General Musharraf has decided to comment on this specific question.
No, I was trying to answer another point of view. This, I don't find it very logical to link Afghanistan or what we did in Afghanistan in response to 9/11 with Iraq. Here was a situation in Afghanistan was that Al-Qaeda, who we equate with terrorism, carried out the 9/11 attack, and many people around the world.
But it was part of the war on terror. And you're for the motion that the war on terror was the right response. Iraq was also a terror threat, you said, and therefore it was a legitimate target in the war on terror. That's what you said. So just very quickly, General Musharraf, was Iraq part of the war on terror? Should it have been?
Well, I personally was certainly against the war in Iraq.
Okay.
But I'm not linking it with attack on terror, really.
Okay, all right, that made it clear. We had that question, Sir Jeremy Greenstock, on the policing of crimes and of terrorism, and the policy had failed.
Well, it was... Well, that question has said policing failed miserably.
That's right, yeah.
And things were missed before 9/11, both internationally and in the United States. But I think this panel must make the point that over the last 10 years, and particularly in the last few years, our police, our agencies in the United States, the UK and elsewhere have done an absolutely fantastic job in protecting us against repetitions of 7/7 and other terrorist attacks earlier in the decade. Let's give the police and the agencies the real credit that they deserve for protecting our public.
I have a comment about the bases in Saudi Arabia. Yeah. I just want to remind that why were the U.S. bases in Saudi Arabia? To protect the Kurds in the north and the Shia in the south in Iraq and the no-fly zones. And so there we were trying to assist, and this is turned against the United States as being in the land of Saudi Arabia. So right. Just a reminder, that's why we were there. And the idea that we should be attacked on 9/11 because we're in Saudi Arabia when we're there to protect the people in Iraq is a nonsense.
And General Musharraf, did Osama bin Laden, who of course was killed by the U.S. Navy SEALs in May in Abbottabad in Pakistan, did he go to Pakistan after you left office?
Well, I can't be sure. I wasn't tracking him, certainly. But he was there in Abbottabad. As far as I'm concerned, whenever anyone asked me where he is, I always said, I don't know. He could be anywhere.
He used to say he's not in Pakistan. He's probably more likely on the Pakistan-Afghan border inside Afghanistan.
When somebody insisted that he's in Pakistan, then I used to say, what is the information? Where did you get this information from? He could be anywhere. He could be in Afghanistan or even outside Afghanistan. So that was what
I
used to say.
Were you surprised when he was bound in Abbottabad?
Yes, indeed. Absolutely. I was shocked that he was in Abbottabad.
I mean, living quite openly in a city, just a few miles from any
not very openly. Not very openly.
Well,
he was locked up in a
room. It was a big house, wasn't it, in an urban area. It wasn't a remote farm.
Sorry?
He wasn't living in a remote farm. It was quite a big townhouse he was living in, quite conspicuous.
The best place, the safest place, is in a thickly populated place. This is a town. All tourists into the mountains of Pakistan go through Abbottabad. A population of 600,000 people. And there are civilians and military people all mixed and stay together.
But, President, at least you better recognize that he was beneficiating, bin Laden, of some complicity. This is impossible to believe that he was isolated, close to the barracks and close to the army and etc. So, I understand your answer, but honestly...
I certainly would like to react to this. After all, slippages or poor performance by the intelligence are possible. If you reflect back to 9/11, how is it that 18 people were being trained for months and CIA was asleep, the most powerful organization? How was it that four airliners are being hijacked from four different airfields and a CIA doesn't know? How is it that through three of them going to the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, CIA is asleep? So let us allow ISI to have been sleeping once at least.
I'm going to go back to the floor. Let's go up there, please, quickly.
My name is Khalil Osman. I'm a sixth form student. I've got a question for Colin Graffy, who was talking about the origins of terror due to Arab dictators. Do you think that's a fair assumption based on the fact that your government propped up these dictators, Mubarak, billions of dollars, second only to Israel, which imposes tyranny on the Palestinians? And let's not forget Saddam Hussein was an American client whilst he was fighting your war against Iran.
Okay, all right. Remember the motion, everybody. Okay. As you make your points, admirably short, but remember the motion. Yes.
I just want to bring it back to the motion. I've got a question for the for panel and a question for the against panel. For the for panel, and please give a direct answer to this, let's separate the name War on Terror from the substance of what actually happened. I don't think we can divorce the symbolisms or the abysmal failures of the decade. Do you support, number one, extraordinary rendition to torture? as part of this war on terror? Do you support, number two, detention without charge, in the case of Guantanamo, for over 10 years? And do you support, number three, invasion and occupation of countries without authorization from the UN? For the against panel... the against panel, I personally and Quilliam, the line we push is we don't see a polarization between necessarily between military action on the one hand and law and order on the other. There's a middle way. We think there's a third way, and that's to empower civil society, as demonstrated by the Arab Spring. So would you please elaborate on what could have been done to, in that third way, to empower civil society rather than take military action? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. That's the quickest four questions I've heard in about a minute, 10 seconds. So let's just pick up then, panel. The point made by the representative from the Quilliam Foundation, which I think was mostly to your side, Mr. Musharraf and Colleen Graffy, which was, when you support the war on terror, do you support detention without charge? Do you support rendition and the invasion of countries without proper UN authorization?
Well, the question had several different parts. The first is torture. No, that is not allowed. The international community has torture convention, but every country is going to, as Britain has done, is going to find ways of interrogation that come pretty close. And in the United States, the view was that the actions taken in waterboarding were not torture. Now, you can disagree with that.
Well, a lot of people did. I mean, it's what you described as enhanced interrogation
and
procedures.
They stopped that, and they considered that it was wrong to do. Okay? The other, with detention, every country is dealing with the difficulty, the tensions between protecting societies and protecting civil rights. So the UK is in the same situation. Control orders, how long do you hold people? Right. France has a similar situation.
Okay, and so Jeremy, the question to the your side from the Quilliam Foundation was, what do you do to empower civil society? What's the alternative to the war on terror? How would you have done it?
Well, civil society is actually doing more than governments, in my view, at the moment, to make the developing world a better place, village by village, town by town, region by region. They don't need to be told what to do by governments. They don't need to be empowered in what they have the will to achieve in the less advantaged areas of the world. But they do need to work with the governments of the developing world to be allowed access to the people who need their help. And when you get that kind of partnership between what the West in its donor mode can give and what the developing world can absorb and receive and act on, you are getting a partnership that does far more to deal with security issues than the direct use of military force. That's what we're trying to say.
Thank you very much for that, Sir Jeremy Greenstock. I've got the result now of the vote after the debate, and it's very interesting. All right, let me first of all remind you how you voted, audience, before the debate started. For the motion, the war on terror was the right response to 9/11, 179 for, 323 against. There were 200 of you who didn't know. So after the debate, this is how you voted. For the motion, the war on terror was the right response, 276, so you did gain some. Against, however, 402. And the don't knows went down to 46. So congratulations to the winners. Commiserations. So thank you very much indeed, panel. Thank you, audience, here at Cadogan Hall in central London, and you at home, wherever you are, for watching. And you can get a free briefing, if you want to, by going to the website www.intelligencesquared.com and just follow the instructions there. But for me, Zainab Badawi, from this Intelligence Squared debate marking this important occasion of the 10th anniversary of the September the 11th attacks, thank you very much. Goodbye.
What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligence Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates, and events for over two decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity, and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? To find out what we can do for your organization, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligencesquared.com/partnerships.